From the heart of rural France, this is the Keto Woman podcast, brought to you by me. Hello, keto lovelies. I'm Daisy Brackenhall, and I've spent most of my life struggling with my weight and confidence, and have always had a difficult relationship with food. Even when I finally got to my target weight after weight loss surgery and eating low carb, I couldn't maintain it and I was miserable. I've been keto now for over 2 years and it has given me the freedom to fall in love with food again without the constant gain, loss, guilt, virtue cycle of before. Health and happiness is where it's at now, running on fat. Welcome to the Keto Woman podcast. Each week I'll be chatting to inspirational women, maybe even the odd man, to discover the secrets to their success so that I can share them with you. So what is keto? Keto is a way of eating that enables you to switch your body's main fuel source from sugar to fat. Who doesn't want to be a fat burner, right? But how do we achieve this? A great place to start is by keeping carbs under 20 grams a day. So things like leafy greens and above ground vegetables, plus some nuts and seeds and the incidental carbs you find in things like full fat dairy. Choose delicious fatty proteins and be free and easy with oily dressings on salad and butter on your veggies. Once you're in the swing of things, you can tweak it to suit you. Make your own personalized keto. You'll hear all sorts of ways to keto from my guests. There is no one way to do keto, no one size fits all. I hope to show you just how flexible and fabulous this way of eating can be. I'm not a doctor, and most of my guests won't be either, so we really can't give you medical advice. It's always best to consult your own doctor when making big changes to your diet and lifestyle, because they know you and your medical history, and so have access to the bigger picture. Wouldn't it be helpful to have one place where you could find all the links? Want to sign up to my new Patreon-exclusive Facebook group, Daisy's Lovelies? No problem. How about subscribing to my YouTube channel? Please help me notch up my first 1,000 subscribers by going to links.ketowomanpodcast.com and following the YouTube link. Not following me on Instagram yet? Hit the Instagram button. You get the idea. All the buttons, all the links you need are at links.ketowomanpodcast.com. Welcome to episode number 174 and the second part of my psycho rerun. If you missed last week's episode, do go back and listen to it first, or you'll miss half of Jessica's answer, and you don't want to do that. Three guests, three answers to the same question. Do you think people with weight to lose need to consider calories if they are experiencing a long plateau when eating a ketogenic diet? Hopefully by now I'm in my new flat and the internet is being connected as we speak. Keep your fingers crossed for me and I'll speak to you soon. That sounds like it's potentially wrapped up with the problems that some people have with the MTHFR gene.
Yeah.
It sounds like it could be linked.
There's a lot of different genes which are going to affect your ability to activate B vitamins and other vitamins and minerals and so on. But yeah, so essentially when I say activation, that actually means methylation. And the MTHFR gene mutation that you're talking about, there's a few different types, but one of the more well-researched ones means that if you've got the mutation, then you have a reduced ability to methylate things in the body. So turning things on or turning things off, like for example, being able to activate a B vitamin to get it into the cell, your body can't do that very well. And you know, there's a lot of people walking around with these genetic mutations who have absolutely no problems. And just because you have a genetic mutation doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to develop these magical problems from it. Everybody's different. It's kind of how it gets expressed in your body. I know with that particular mutation, a lot of people end up with miscarriages and problems with fertility. because we know that folate, vitamin B9, is essential to grow a new human and to be fertile. And so if you're not activating vitamin B9 and you're not able to actually get that into your cells and tissues, then yeah, there could be problems with fertility and there could be problems with having a healthy baby, which is awful to think about and awful to think that there's a lot of people that may have this mutation and may have those issues but don't know it and don't know how to actually test whether or not they are deficient in B9 or B12. So you can get tested for the mutation pretty easily. You just ask your doctor to throw on a test for MTHFR and they can just do it with your regular blood test. And if you want to know about it, you can know about it. I mean, really the way you sort of manage that mutation is by checking on homocysteine anyway. So, you know, it's more linked to those deficiencies in B12 and B9. So if you're looking at your homocysteine and keeping that in a good range, then it doesn't really matter whether you have the mutation or not, kind of thing. But a lot of people like to delve into their health more. I would put a big beware sticker on that though, because it is a little bit scary. If you type in or if you Google the MTHFR genetic mutation, I don't know, have you Googled it?
Yeah, a whole slew.
Oh, yeah. It's like all the worst things, you know, just pop up, like cancer, depression, stroke, miscarriage, nerve damage, Alzheimer's. It's like everything that you want to not get in life is what you're now learning you're at greater risk of. And so, you know, it was really scary finding out that I had that. And I'm a health professional who's able to look through the literature and kind of decipher through it and figure out what I need to do. But there's a lot of people that would just completely overwhelm them and be far too much. And maybe they don't even need to worry about it. That's the thing. It's going to be a different outcome for different people depending on your lifestyle. You may have absolutely no problem whatsoever with the mutation, or it could be something that's crucial in your health journey to find out about.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it can totally be overwhelming, but it can also be that missing link for something. Like, for example, when I interviewed Carrie Brown, and when she discovered that there was this problem, it was suddenly, you know, light bulbs going on everywhere, and gave her a way to treat and reverse, you know, her bipolar disorder along with eating keto. It's a relief to somebody like that, because they find out one of these root causes and the problems, and it gives them a path for treatment. But yes, I can totally see the other way. If you're not looking for something, if you're not looking to try and fix a problem, and you suddenly find out that potentially you're vulnerable to a whole myriad of things, that could be very scary. So I suppose it depends what angle you're coming at.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And I'll just quickly finish up by saying what you just said there about knowing she had the mutation, and that knowledge and that management strategy in combination with the ketogenic diet is important, actually, because she may, let's say, as an example, never knew she had the mutation, but went and changed her diet, and she could have still ended up improving her health with the same outcomes. It's obviously going to depend. This is completely, I actually didn't listen to the interview. I don't know her, but you don't have to know you've got it. You can still just make the best decisions for your health and keep going on how you're usually, you know, doing your health goals and then working towards them, fixing your diet, whatever it is. And you can still be fine. You don't always have to know you have it. And so the ketogenic diet, the way it can help with the MTHFR mutation is by reducing or eliminating your intake of folic acid. Did she discuss this?
Not so much. It was more she found a big improvement just with the ketogenic diet, and that really helped with her bipolar, but then that didn't take her quite far enough. And by discovering that she had this gene mutation, that's when she started supplementing with methylated B vitamins. Perfect. And noticed a huge improvement after doing that.
Yeah, that's awesome. And so where that first benefit could have come in, obviously there's all those mechanisms with the ketones that would be good for brain signaling and all of that, But as well, if you go on a ketogenic diet, you're essentially getting rid of a lot of products containing wheat. And wheat is fortified, at least in Australia, most countries, is fortified with folic acid, which is the synthetic form of folate, which is actually really not good for somebody with an MTHFR mutation because you can't process it. So you can't activate that folic acid and turn it into the folate you actually need. It's a synthetic form, which they say is very bioavailable. They say, oh, folic acid, you can absorb it really well, all is well. But you can't actually then go and activate that if you've got this genetic mutation. So having folic acid or a lot of folic acid can sometimes make your symptoms worse. So step one could be getting rid of the excess folic acid. And then as Carrie has shared, step two might then have to be going supplementing with those vitamins that you've been missing out on. And certainly that was the same with me. So I cut out my folic acid and had some benefit, not very noticeable with my nerve health, and then learning about this mutation and what it does with the activation of the vitamins just opened this whole new door for me, because I was at the point of my investigation of my nerve damage where I was kind of ready to give up. I was saying, this is the last person I'm going to see about this, and then I'm just never going to talk about it again. I'm just going to deal with the pain. But now it's like I've got this hope again. So it is, yeah, it's cool, but it is overwhelming.
Yeah.
So people out there, you know, if you're going to test for genetics, take your genetic test to somebody who knows how to deal with it and talk to you about it in a way that is applicable to you.
Yes, real and practical solutions rather than being overwhelming. I think it's fascinating how we start. I always wince when someone talks about calorie counting and should I lower my calories? I get this reflex. And I think straight away to start with, you started talking about energy intake. And I think I prefer to think of calories as energy intake. And yes, it might be necessary to literally reduce how much you're eating. But I think it just goes to show, and you've highlighted with potentially things that you need to supplement. I mean, and there are a whole load of other things that you could be looking at, like stress and sleep and all kind of things. But I think what's so interesting is that we tend to jump straight to that conclusion because it's been rammed into our brains that you've got to keep your calories down if you want to lose weight. But actually, there's a whole load of other things that you should be looking at first, and they all revolve around improving your health and well-being. And actually, it could be those that you need to look at, probably are those that you need to look at, rather than jumping straight on with cutting calories.
Exactly right. You said it. It was actually a really great question, because it's funny how we started with calories and then ended up with genetics. So it just goes to show, you know, there's so many different things. And I think it's not a pretty answer when you can't give a yes or no answer to that. You know, it's not pretty, but it's the truth.
Yeah, just like you were saying in the interview, people generally, we all like a yes or no answer, but it's just more complicated than that, isn't it? That sort of, you know, it depends. Well, maybe, but the other thing is, what's a plateau? You can get people saying they're on a plateau, they haven't lost weight for it, and you find out it's just been a week. Well, that's certainly not what I'd think of as a plateau. I mean, I would go for months at a time without losing weight. Again, it's just a natural part of the process, isn't it? Of just leveling out every now and then.
Yeah, super good point. I think that was my top tip on your last podcast. On our first interview, it was my top tip. I remember saying, you know, weight plateaus are a good thing, or can be a good thing. Because, yeah, we don't just lose a kilo a week until we reach our goal. That's not how our body works. We're not machines. So having that period where you've lost some weight and then stabilizing, so your whole energy homeostasis can reset and actually, you know, get that new set point and not work against you the whole time, then can allow you to safely lose some more weight and more effectively lose weight and keep it off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of your body always wanting to revert back to the start weight, it will revert back to where it's last got that homeostasis, if you do ever sort of revert. That's because people are so afraid of putting all the weight back on. And well, yeah, maybe if you lose it all at once by drastic measures, maybe you will put it back on. But if you do it slowly and gradually with those, you know, stepwise reductions and stabilizations in between, then you're probably not going to put it back on.
Yes, I always think of it as your body just taking a bit of a breather.
Mm.
This whole losing weight business, it takes quite a lot of work. It takes quite a lot out of the body. I just want to rest and sit where I am for the time being. But I love what you were saying about it's a good way of just slowly bringing your set point down over time rather than your body wanting to go back up. But we do panic. I think if we're someone who's been overweight for a long period of time and we're used to either gaining or losing weight, that's what it's always been. It's been the cycle of one or the other. And we lump maintaining a loss in with gaining because it's not a loss.
Yes.
And we shouldn't. It's a perfect place to be in, just holding your weight.
Mm. You could argue the same for like HbA1c, for example. If your HbA1c is 6.4 and then you get it tested 3 years later and it's still 6.4, I would be patting you on the back saying, great job, you're doing something right, you know, because it's not progressively going up, okay? But if we want to get it down, what can we do? And yeah, people are too quick to just find the negative in things. And we need to look at outcomes not as like just good or bad, you know, we need to think of them more on sort of just like a continuum, like a scale. So
absolutely.
Oh my gosh, we've almost recorded another podcast here.
No, I was just gonna say thank you so much. This is our first bonus content package, and what a bonus content it is. Thank you so much, Jessica, for taking that extra time.
That's all right. I think I was about to say something else, and then I was like, you know what? I think my brain's fried now. It's my bedtime. So
I've been draining. I've been sucking the life out of your brain. And this is, you recorded another podcast earlier as well, so you must be completely frazzled.
No, it's fine. I loved it. And I think this is fantastic to everyone who's a patron of Keto Woman. I think that's great. So I'm happy to give this long interview at 11:30.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much. We're going to switch off now and I'm going to let you get some sleep.
All right. Good night. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome, Annette. How are you doing?
Great. Nice to see you again, Daisy. Thanks for having me on. I really enjoy our conversations.
Yeah, me too. We've been laughing and chatting a lot before we started recording, as usual. Okay, so this month's question is, do you think people with weight to lose need to consider calories if they are experiencing a long plateau when eating a ketogenic diet? The old calories question.
That is a great question, too. It is not a flash in the pan answer either. So it's a perfect place for this forum, which gives us the space to take the time and correctly answer the question. So let's begin with the first intake of people coming into a ketogenic diet. And you'll hear, don't count calories, only count carbs. Don't count calories, only count carbs. And it is the right answer for that beginning patient or person on a ketogenic diet. Their body has been insulating or protecting those stored calories because they've been on a low-fat diet, and the chemistry has really shifted to this insulin resistance that everybody talks about, where insulin will insulate your body. And the reason it does that is because of the chemistry changes that have happened over time while holding on to your body weight. So if their body has held on to an extra 10 or 15 pounds or even 20 pounds for the better part of a year, God help them if it's 50 pounds for the better part of 5 years, you can nearly guarantee that that insulin resistance is present in the patient. So you say, well, how do you reverse it? And the number one first thing you must do is lower those carbohydrates enough to stop stimulating the production of insulin. So it becomes about the focus of how do we get insulin down? And that is, don't think about those calories. You're going to see bite for bite, the most dense calories come from fat. And I want you eating 80 to 90% fat when you first become ketogenic. And they, you know, start looking at their urine ketone strips. They start to have it pink and eventually it's nice and purple. And now they've shifted their chemistry. to have a ketogenic diet, to have ketones in their circulation, to have enough ketones to waste them out their urine. And that's the chemistry shift that we want them to do, which we can then have a pretty solid guess that their insulin is low when their ketones are that high.
It's an interesting question. Actually, I've just got to ask you about those pea strips, because it's something that comes up a lot. And some people say that they lose effectiveness, if you like, the longer you're on keto, probably because you're starting to use them more. So you're not peeing them out anymore, because that's the thing. It's just measuring what you're
wasting,
isn't it? But just one specific question about the color, because I know that it can be said if you get the color that's on the end of the strip, the dark purple, some people say that potentially that can be because you're dehydrated.
Right.
And you actually need a bit more water. The reason they're coming out so densely is, it's a concentration.
Right, it's a concentration. But the same thing could happen first thing in the morning. So if you've been in a nice ketogenic state and, you know, your, let's say your last meal yesterday was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you were really tired, you went to bed, you got up the next morning. You haven't voided, you haven't urinated for over 12 hours. Mm. But what is collected in your bladder is the urine that is filled with ketones. And so you get up in the morning and it's this nice dark purple. Well, is that because the last hour of your production of ketones was so great? No, that's because for 12 hours, you've had this sac inside your lower pelvis called a bladder that's been collecting urine. And over the last 12 hours, you keep putting a little drip, drip, drip into that bladder. And now it has this highly concentrated ketone-rich urine. So when you pee on it...
Right. So it depends a bit when you're taking it. And is that... Would you say that is the best time to test then? Your first pee of the day, basically?
I tell patients that the cleanest time to test ketones and glucose is first thing in the morning. And it's because there's less noise in their life. For urine ketones, what I tell them to do is empty your bladder, go have a cup of coffee, and then check your urine ketones on the second void of the day.
Oh, interesting.
So if you've got urine collected overnight, there's so many variables for how much is in the urine. Did you get up in the night to go potty? There's so many parts that become things I need to calculate to say, well, is that a clean urine? Did it? So if you do the second one, then you're saying of the drips of urine that have come into the bladder in the last hour, were there ketones? And that's a better measurement. But when patients first shift into a ketogenic diet, I tell them to check that 3 or 4 times a day. It's cheap. It's easy. You can put those urine ketone strips in your pocket. And every time you go to the bathroom, you can just have affirmation. Am I in a ketogenic zone or not? And that reassurance for patients has been so powerful because they're on this ketogenic diet. It sounds like a crackpot idea that you're eating 80% fat. And so that mind shift, that cognitive dissonance where they're like, I don't know, this doctor says I'm going to lose weight if I eat fat. And they are so, you know, like, this doesn't make any sense for what I've learned over the last 20 years. And I'm like, hang in there. As long as you're peeing a ketone, we're going to be okay. But I need you proving to me that those ketones are coming out your urine. And I don't want them following calories. I don't want them understanding that.
And everyone loves that little color change. It's like people like these quizzes online. It's just these little easy tests. And someone told me a genius thing, actually, to get more strips for your money. And you can just cut them in half lengthways. And there you go. You've got, yes, you've got two strips. So do the same thing.
Right. Because those strips do, they're just a little sponge that has a chemical on it. And as long as the ketone touches that chemical, it turns it a color. So those strips are cheap, easy, safe, and they are very powerful in how well you can have feedback for whether or not you're in the chemistry set in your own body that's losing weight.
And there's an easy way, isn't there, to tell if you're dehydrated. I just always say to people like that when they're worried because they've heard that if it comes up purple all the time that they're dehydrated and they're going to run into problems. I say, well, just look at the color of your pee.
Yep, exactly.
If it's pale in color, then you're fine.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
If it's dark, then yeah, you may need to drink a bit more water.
Right. And even if they drink a bit more water, it's really what I think of urine ketones are is not so much how is the gradation of that, of those different shades of pink to purple. Think of it as a plus or minus. If it's pink, you're producing ketones.
Yeah.
If it's not pink, then you're not producing ketones. And, you know, so now fast forward, the patient's lost 20 pounds. We're now 4 months into ketosis. They've gotten it figured out. They've got a pattern of what they're doing. Or let's even go further. Let's go 6 months. They lost the first 20 pounds and then they stalled out because they're doing something different. And this is where they'll come to me saying, should I start counting calories? And I personally would say, no, I want you to start looking at the clock. For my patients, I talk about how important it is to give your liver a break. It needs rest. And you're like, what are you talking about? I'm like, when you look at fatty livers or what insulin does over time, it stores sugar in that liver. In order to undo that, I need it to have times every day where it's resting. So if you look at the first thing your liver does in the morning, if you are used to waking up at 7 o'clock in the morning, about 5:30 or 6 o'clock, a hormone called cortisol pings from your brain to send glucose into your bloodstream through the liver. So there is a little ringing bell at about an hour before you wake up where the cortisol level in your body sends from your brain to your liver to give your body sugar. And that is the awakening of your liver. So if your liver wakes up every morning at 6:30, I need at 6:30 at night for it to shut off. Don't ask your liver to do any more work. And that means you probably should have eaten an hour before that, because if you put food in right now, your liver is going to have to be busy for the next hour undoing or taking care of that food. So when people get hit a plateau and they're several weeks into a ketogenic diet, I look at time-restricted eating. This is where hand-in-hand ketosis and fasting come into state. And many times the patient, and I did this as well, I gave up the first meal of the day because I wasn't hungry. I had my coffee, and then I could even make it to like 2 o'clock in the afternoon before I really said, I feel like I should be eating.
Yeah, me too.
And it had to be a mindful shift in my, because I was like, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. And it was in my pattern. I really like eggs and bacon. So it was very easy for me to eat that. But I found that it was also probably the easiest meal for me to first give up was breakfast, that I really didn't feel hungry. So if I was looking at the perfect script for a ketogenic person, though, I would have them give up evening hours or evening eating. I did this one meal a day or, you know, don't eat till 2 o'clock. And then sometimes I'd have a snack around 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, depending on family rhythm. But what was happening is my liver wasn't getting as much of a break. And I find this happens with patients as well, that they'll find a way to get to one meal a day. But eventually we address the fact that your liver, whether or not you give it permission or give it food, it wakes up with a circadian rhythm that is based on sunlight. So that sunlight and a morning awakening happens, and time-restricted eating, the beginning of the timer starts when your liver wakes up. That is when I would set a 12-hour clock to say, at 12 hours from that moment, I would have you stop putting anything except water and salt past your lips.
So the earlier you can do that, the better. I mean, I'm like a lot of people that like to probably eat my biggest meal in the evening. But in an ideal world, you would have your one meal, your two meals, your three meals, however many meals you're having, as early as possible in the day and stop as early as possible.
Right. So the time-restricted eating is because if you say, Doc, I think I need to lessen the calories that I take in. I'm on this ketogenic diet and I think I'm having too many calories. And I will say, fix the chemistry first. The chemistry is, did you give your liver a break 12 hours before it has to start working again? And it has to start working when the sun comes up. It is related to the sun. Your circadian rhythm, which is where cortisol surges come from, is related to the sun.
Whether you like it or not.
I know, right? I mean, I have shift workers that come to me and say, but Doc, I've been doing this for 20 years. I'm like, okay, let's test you. I will contend that you're going to have a rise in your sugar at about 7 o'clock in the morning. And we can put you on a continuous glucose monitor. And sure enough, their rise in the sugar may have shifted by a half an hour. They're like, but Doc, I'm up all night. I've been doing this for 20 years. I work the night shift at the hospital. I'm like, I know. And it's paid your bills. I get it. But it's not good for your body. And your circadian rhythm still says, thousands of years of evolution says we follow the sun. I'm like, but, I'm like, you're human. That's what that looks like. So when you rise with the sun, your liver starts its day. Give that liver 12 hours of work, which means at about 10 and a half hours is the last time you should be eating food, because that's going to be about another hour to an hour and a half of what your liver needs to do to satisfy that final meal. But then salt and water is the only thing that should be coming through your lips after that.
So really, you would include beverages in that, mm-hmm. even like black coffee and tea, would you, mm-hmm. you would include them?
Yep.
Gosh.
Because those two still require enzymes from the liver to process.
Right.
And water, salt, no. So when people say, should I count calories? I say, no, you should count hours. How many hours a day did you ask your liver to work? And when people say, yeah, doc, I did great. I fasted until 4 o'clock and then I had a little bite and then I had a snack and I had some pistachio nuts and then I had a cup of tea. And I'm like, so pretty much your liver worked for the last 20 of the 24 hours because, you know, maybe it wasn't quite that long, but they have 16 hours of work for the liver and then maybe 8 hours of sleeping, but that's not enough for your liver to reset. And it will shift the chemistry to be more storage, more insulation, more storage, more insulation. And if you're not losing weight, it's because you didn't let your liver reset overnight in a consistent pattern.
I love this way of looking at pretty well everything else that is going on in your life before you ever and probably never have to look at calories. Because if you do all those things and you're eating ketogenically, it's going to be almost impossible to eat too much in that context. And I would throw into the mix here the things that you maybe have a tendency to overeat. So there might be certain foods that you need to restrict rather than calories. I discussed this a bit with Richard, but things that you know you tend to overeat, maybe, you know, nuts. And if you're making sort of sweet fat bomb type things, the kind of things that you can just keep popping those things in and eat them all the time. You might have to restrict those kind of things, but you're not. Yes, okay, you are restricting calories by restricting them, but that's not the reason.
No.
You can eat as much as you like calorie wise of all the other things that you don't overeat. So it's really not about calories. It's about the impact
right.
that food might have on you.
Right. And I think if a patient is asking you, should I count calories? Do they matter? There is a scientific answer over here that matters that I could go through, and it's the physiology of what calories and blah, blah, blah. But you're going to lose the audience. The patient is asking you, doctor, I can't seem to lose weight. What should I focus on? And I'm saying you should focus on the fact that your liver didn't get a timeout. And it needs one every day for 12 hours. If you've overused your liver for the better part of a decade, which is why you carry the extra 20 pounds around or extra whatever weight you carry, to undo that, I need your liver to rest for 12 hours a day. That's where you should focus if you want the weight to come off. It doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, I look back at most of the patients that I take care of. They naturally give up breakfast. They naturally give up lunch. They go to the one meal a day. And then they come in and say, doc, but I'm stalled. I'm at one meal a day. How can I fix this? And that love-hate relationship that I have with macadamia nuts, you know, I remember this in my story. And then I use that as a parallel to say, here's the mistake I made is I loved macadamia nuts and I had eaten my one meal a day, but walking past that as I'd go to bed, I'd grab a few more and I'd grab a few more. And before I knew it, I was the only person in my family eating those macadamia nuts. So not putting them in the cupboard turned out to be the right answer. But in that same aspects, it was a habit that was in my life kind of on auto program. And to lose the weight, I really needed to address that in my habits. And if I'm looking at where should I get the patient to focus? Should I get them to focus on counting calories? And the answer is you have a set of hormones in your body that will shut off and will suppress appetite if you can increase the number of ketones circulating in your blood. Well, how do you do that? You must give the liver a rest for the 12 hours a day, and the timer starts with the circadian rhythm in the morning.
Perfect.
Yeah.
As always, it's fascinating talking to you, and I learned so much. Thank you.
I also think that there's a place where when you give advice to patients, give them the tool that says, how do you fix the problem?
Exactly.
I've had this metabolic debate people say calories do matter. I'm like, calories matter, but you have to first have the right chemistry set before you should ever talk about that. So what I'm really shifting the patient to focus on is, I mean, you can check your chemistry in the morning, first thing while you're sitting on the toilet, check your morning fasting sugar and your morning ketones. And what you can do by looking at those two numbers at once is you can estimate the insulin level. And I use something called the Dr. Boz ratio. And really it's like the GKI that's used in the research, which has to do with, do you have the right millimolars to do a ketone? And is it a 1-to-2 ketone or 1-to-4 ketone or 1-to-1 ketone based on glucose and ketones? Most of my patients have brain fog. That's way too much math for them to do. So we take the glucose and we divide the ketones into it. And if you want weight loss, you should always have a morning ratio of 80 or less. If you want a metabolism reset, which is really what my diabetics need to do, it's what my people with immune responses, whether that's psoriasis or thyroiditis or colitis or lupus, all those autoimmune processes that are kind of the body is attacking itself. How do you reset that immune system? Their morning fasting ratio should be less than 40. And if I am hardcore, like somebody I was taking care of, like my mother who had cancer, when we're in a treatment protocol, her morning fasting ratio should be less than 20. That is really hard to get to.
I bet.
And it is the only time where I can have incredible confidence that her body is got low insulin and that the autophagy is got a really good chance of working when that morning fasting ratio is less than 20. And all of those collections of data points are to help reassure the patient that you're there, you're getting there. This is a calculatable process. And those are the tools we use to do that. So measure the things that actually have evidence and science behind them in the moment. And calories are a side discussion until the chemistry is doing what it's supposed to do.
And it's such an inaccurate measuring system anyway. I almost want to throw it out the window on that alone.
Yeah, for thousands of years, we maintained weight without ever worrying about calories. No, now we have calories and we calculate them on the side of every package. And we're not doing any better with weight loss. We're still a very obese population.
Exactly. And every tool you're using to measure is an estimate anyway. Nothing's ever going to be completely accurate. I always use my bacon as an example. It's the same nutritional stats on every pack of bacon. Yet there is bacon in the shop that has almost no fat on it. And there's the packets that has a load of fat on it, which is the, I go through all the bacon packets and pull out the ones that have got all the fat on them because they're the ones that I like. Yet the nutritional stats will say that the protein and the fat levels in both of those packets are the same. Well, they're obviously not. So that's how inaccurate they are. So I never like to rely on that kind of information anyway, but it's great to just have that reinforcement that there's this huge, great long checklist of things to go through and fix before you ever need to start counting calories.
Amen. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Focus on the places you're going to get a reward. And this is the place you're going to get a reward.
That was very much my arms in the air. Hallelujah. Absolutely. I don't ever want to have to count calories again. Been there, done that.
You want to find therapist rooms filled with traumatized patients. Go to those people counting calories. But doc, I'm still not losing weight. I'm like, I know. You've got a chemistry set that needs to be fixed.
But it's also when you've got that focus, I can remember doing it. I can remember however long I made myself do 1500 calories or less. You find ways of sneaking in things you want. I found ways of juggling that calorie total for the day so that I could have my Magnum ice cream every day. and of course it only worked with me staying at 1500 or fewer calories until I went mad and binged on the whole packet of Magnum ice creams and it all went out the window anyway. So there you go. It's just a waste of time.
Yeah, the suffering is exponential in that department of counting calories. So focus on the place where you can make a difference. That's your chemistry.
Perfect. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure as always.
You bet. Have a good one.
To get the resources and links from this show, please go to ketowomanpodcast.com/episodes. Please share this podcast with as many people as possible by sharing one of my links or just taking a screenshot of an episode that you enjoyed. Reviews really help raise the profile of the podcast, which gets it in front of more people, but also helps me attract a wide variety of guests. So please take a minute to leave a review on whichever podcast app or platform you like to listen on. It doesn't go unnoticed by me, the people who regularly like, share, and comment on my posts. Your support really does mean the world to me. Thank you. Are you enjoying this podcast? Help me make more episodes and videos by making a pledge at my Patreon page, patreon.com/ketowoman, or simply hit the support button on the Keto Woman podcast website. Don't forget to join in the fun on the Keto Woman podcast Instagram and Facebook pages, and Daisy_KetoWoman on Twitter. Are you my next extraordinary woman? Maybe you've got an idea for a show, a topic you would like to hear about. Let me know how I can tickle your earbuds by dropping me a line at daisy@ketowomanpodcast.com. This week's end quote is from Billy Idol. If your world doesn't allow you to dream, move to one where you can. Bye-bye, keto lovelies.